Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
History is the memory of states. These are the words of Henry Kissinger. In contrast, Howard Zinn says, you can't be neutral on a moving train. That is, history has no bystanders, only participants. As participants, we want history that reflects our interest. Howard Zinn has written the well-known People's History of the United States, as well as numerous other books. He's a historian and a playwright, and he was active in the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements. And he joins us on the phone from his home in Boston to discuss history as a tool for achieving social change. Good morning, Howard, and welcome to Red Eye.
Oh, good morning.
Howard, you're extremely well-known for your book, A People's History of the United States. What kind of history helped develop your perspective on history?
Well, I guess I started reading outside the classroom when I was going to college and graduate school, and I found that the things that interested me were things I was not finding in the classroom. I had been a shipyard worker from the age of 18 for about 3 years. I'm a member of the union and organizer of the union. I became interested in labor history. I didn't find very much labor history of labor struggles of working people in my classes or in my textbooks. So I began to look outside and began to read about the great struggles of working people in the United States, which were not being reported. And then I'd been in the war. I'd been a bombardier in the American Air Force. I turned against the idea of war as a solution, and I wanted to read not about war heroes and military heroes, not about, you know, Theodore Roosevelt and General Pershing and Patton. I wanted to read about the people who struggled against war, about Helen Keller and Emma Goldman and Thoreau and Eugene Debs. I began to read on my own about people who had been, in my mind, heroes other than the usual heroes of American history, you know, the presidents and the members of Congress and the military heroes and the industrialists.
And how did that form your views of our official sources of information, the sort of textbooks that we look at and the media that we're exposed to on a regular basis?
Well, I soon realized that what we were getting in the official versions of history was really the kind of history that created passive citizens, because there was that kind of history concentrating on the people at the top, the important people that would lead Americans to believe that anything important that happened was initiated by the people on top. Studying social movements and then participating in social movements, it became clear that, you know, democracy only comes alive when people, ordinary people, organize, get together, form social movements, whether it's labor movements, black movements against racial segregation, women's movements, then democracy comes alive. So I became very skeptical of governments, and I certainly became skeptical of governments when a war situation arose and the government rushed to go to war, to send our young people to war, to kill other young people in other countries, and almost always for no good reason except power and profit.
You've been at it for a long time now, writing and researching the histories of people in the United States and in the world. How would you, at this point, define the role of a historian?
Well, of course, everybody defines it in a different way. To me, the role of a historian is to use history in such a way as to throw light on the issues of today. You know, I mean, as a historian, I want to look at what happened on September 11th in New York. I want to look at, you know, terrorism and look at the American response to it. And I want to see if history can throw any light on that. And in fact, I would say to people, look, if you want to really look with a clear eye at what happened on September 11th. He wanted to look with real clarity at what the government is doing. Look at the history of wars. Look at the history of government deception. I mean, there's a history of long history where governments deceive the citizenry when they send them to war. I mean, the most obvious example is Vietnam, which was full of lies, but all wars have been accompanied by lies, and the present war on Afghanistan is being accompanied by lies.
In Canada, we're, as you are in the United States, facing new anti-terrorist legislation that could suspend our access here to the Access to Information Act, and has many other kind of effects on dissenters to the war. What are your thoughts on the seriousness of this?
Well, the seriousness of that is simply that as soon as you begin to pass legislation which makes people afraid that they're going to be prosecuted if they criticize the government, then you are eroding the free marketplace of ideas, which is what we need if we are going to be able to evaluate government policy. Historically, this happens in every war situation. The government begins to clamp down on free speech. And their argument is, well, we're in a war, and in a war you can't afford free speech. And my counter-argument would be that it is especially in times of war, or especially in times when you are deciding whether you want to go into war or continue a war, especially at such times you need a total freedom of speech, because you need all the arguments you can summon up. You need all the ideas, and because if you just let the government go ahead and do what it wants without dissent, and you suppress people's right to free speech by passing legislation, by creating an atmosphere of intimidation, well, then you're setting yourself up for the kind of things that we have happened too often. And by that kind of thing, I mean the government sending young people to war and leading to huge amounts of bloodshed for no good reason.
In the past, you've quoted George Orwell's, who said who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. When George Orwell said who controls the present controls the past. No, he was saying that the people in charge of our culture, the mass media, you know, the great conglomerates that own the big television stations and that make the movies and that own the chains of newspapers, they control what we know of the past. In fact, what they do most of the time is they ignore the past, or they choose that part of the past that will serve the interests of the establishment. So, yes, the people who control us in the present control what we know of the past. They control what goes into the textbooks. They will decide that, no, we're going to pass quickly over Vietnam because otherwise it will be embarrassing and people get the idea that they cannot trust government. So, yes, they control the past, and since they control the past, they will control the future. Because if you don't know the past, if you're deprived of history, then you will believe anything that people in authority say. You will have no way of checking up on them. And then, yes, they will control the future.
I'm very interested, Howard, in the way that you've kind of approached your work, because, I mean, you could be hanging in there in the ivory towers as a historian, but you've been very kind of out there and involved in the activism of the movements. How do you see these roles of historian and activist coming together?
Well, it became most clear to me when I was teaching in the South, and I taught for 7 years at Spelman College in Atlanta, which is a black women's college. I taught there in the years of the civil rights movement, the movement against racial segregation. And I soon had to leave the classroom and go out and join the picket lines and the sit-ins and the protests because my students were doing it. And it became clear to me that for me to simply teach them history and teach them about democracy and liberty, and then be passive and idle while important struggles for democracy and liberty were going on, this would be a false kind of teaching. And so from that point on, that was my first teaching job, it became clear to me that the best kind of teaching a teacher does is not just what goes on in the classroom, but what the teacher does outside the classroom and what the teacher encourages students to do outside the classroom, and that has become active citizens and not just academicians, scholars sitting in the library turning out things that small numbers of people will read. And then, as an activist, you are more in need of history, more in need of information. And so the two really reinforce one another in very good ways. My students in Atlanta came back from prison after being in jail for demonstrating, and they turned to their books with much greater eagerness to find out what are the roots of all of this. You know, what are the roots of racial segregation, and what are the roots of government inaction in the face of racial segregation? So, you know, the two reinforce one another. And I must say, for myself personally, sort of life has been a lot more interesting going back and forth from the world of teaching and scholarship to the world of movements and activism, much more interesting and much more satisfying than if I had just remained a kind of, yes, ivory tower scholar, turning out the tomes and getting awards that, and sort of satisfying myself as a professional.
History has been presented to us, or at least people's first experience with history in North America would be when they went to school, and it's kind of presented it to us as if it's a sort of objective, value-free thing where, you know, you have an accurate history. Is that a concept that we should accept?
Oh, well, absolutely not. It deceives us. Just as newspapers deceive us when they say they're being objective. Historians cannot possibly be objective for the simple reason that as soon as you begin to present the past, you are choosing from an enormous amount of data what to present. Just as newspapers, and I suppose radio stations, out of enormous number of things that happen every day, they choose what they want to present. And in choosing what they want to present, both the historian and the journalist are choosing on the basis of what they think is important. And, and the people who run the newspapers and television stations, for instance, right now in the United States, you know, think it's more important to tell the American public, you know, what the military strategists are saying about invading Afghanistan, they think it more important to tell them that than to give them a clear picture of the horrors we are creating in Afghanistan by our bombing. They're choosing not to highlight the suffering that's going on in Afghanistan as a result of our bombing, the hundreds of thousands of refugees we're creating. They choose not to do that, and they say so explicitly. They say, oh, this will feed into the propaganda of the enemy. However, it happens to be the truth, whether it feeds into the propaganda of the enemy, and that's a truth they want to leave out. And so, yeah, yes, they, and historians, you know, historians teaching about the, teaching about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, World War II, they will talk about how the bombs ended the war and leave people with a satisfied feelings about dropping the atomic bombs. And my guess is that the historians will not, that's more than my guess, it's the actuality, will leave out the fact that the Japanese were on the verge of surrender, that we did not have to drop those atom bombs, we did not have to invade Japan, we weren't saving lives, we were committing atrocities. So, yes, there's no such thing as objectivity. You choose what is important, and you present it. And so it's very important for people reading history, just as important for people reading newspapers, to ask, what is being left out? I mean, the most important question you could ask about something that is presented to you is not, are they lying to me about this particular thing, but what are they leaving out?
And I guess conversely, there's a tremendous value to people who are fighting for social change to understanding the histories that are important to us, that do inform our struggles.
Yes. You know, I think one of the reasons for studying the history of social movements is that you realize that you're not helpless. You read the history of the movement against racial segregation, and you see that it started with a very small number of people, and it started without the cooperation of the United States government. In fact, with the United States government standing off while people were being beaten in the South, and you learn from that as you see the movement grow, and as you see what happens when the movement gets large enough and powerful enough so that the government becomes embarrassed and nervous, and finally the government begins to act to pass important legislation. What you learn from that is the importance of citizen action. What you learn from that is that people who seem to be powerless, and we all feel powerless in the face of the power of government, people who seem to be powerless can become powerful if they organize, if they protest, if they resist what is being done, and if they keep on, if they persist. You see this in the history of the civil rights movement. You see it in the history of the labor movement and the women's movement and the movement against the war in Vietnam. You see movements start out very small, apparently helpless, and you see them grow. They grow because they are representing something important and something that other people begin to recognize. And as other people begin to recognize that, as other people begin to recognize that it's wrong to have racial segregation, it's wrong to have sexual inequality, it's wrong for people to work 12 hours a day, it's wrong for people to go into a bloody war and kill other people. As more and more people begin to realize that, the movement grows and grows until it begins to have an effect. And you realize that, yes, you do have power.
Well, Howard, it's been a tremendous pleasure talking with you this morning. Thanks very, very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking with Howard Zinn. Howard is a historian as well as an author and playwright, and he's well known for many books, including A People's History of the United States.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.